You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away, so it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Hunting Collective. I'm Ben O'Brien, and today I am standing in the middle of an icy lake at Fort Peck in Montana with my good friend Andrew McKean, who's most recently the editor-in-chief of Outdoor Life, one of the better writers and thinkers that I know in our industry, and a good friend of mine. We've traveled the world together, and we're here in his hometown of Glasgow to do a little ice fishing. So this whole podcast, we were sitting, kneeling around an ice hole. In fact, his legs fell asleep during the podcast. Kneeling around an ice hole, trying to catch a big lake trout. So that was a huge part of it. But the other part we wanted to talk about was recruit, retention, and reactivation. The R3 model of getting hunters in our bucket and keeping them there. So it was a great conversation. A lot of fun here on the lake. We haven't caught any fish, but I've been happy to just be in this beautiful country and talk about hunting. So it's the first ever ice fishing podcast for the Hunting Collective. An unsuccessful one, but fun nonetheless. Enjoy. Oh, here we're going. Hey, Andrew McKean.
Hey, Ben O'Brien.
How's it going?
That's good.
Oh, man.
My hands are warmed up.
Let me take a quick swig of this old Milwaukee Light as we get going here.
That'll warm you right up.
It's a little bit frozen.
Yeah, it's a little slushy.
It's got a little slush in it, which is not a big deal at all for me at this point. We are, it's a good way to always start these podcasts. What, you describe where we are.
We are sitting on our knees in a desolate expanse of frozen lake.
We very much are doing that.
We're off of Shaft House Point on Fort Peck Reservoir. I got a fishing rod here that's about 18 inches long in 500 feet of water. Okay, maybe it's only 100 feet of water, but it might as well be 500.
Might as well be 500. Same amount of fish come out of either one. It's amazing country out here, man.
This is the homeland.
You live here.
I am so excited that you're here.
I'm so excited to be here. I am so excited to be here. It like I said, just moving to Montana, and you know, you always were the intrepid outdoor editor who found the perfect spot to live.
So
the rest of us are jealous.
Well, now that you haven't been here through all of winter or mosquito season, and there's only about a week and a half in between the two. It can be a challenging place to live, but yeah. So my hometown is Glasgow, Montana.
Yeah.
This is Fort Peck Reservoir, which is the largest body of water in the state of Montana.
Yeah. It's, what did you say? It has as much shoreline as the state of California?
That's right. And far fewer rockfish.
And far more ice fish and rednecks. There's We're sitting in the middle of kind of a shanty town of sorts. Not the kind of shanty town that you don't really think of, but this is an ice shanty town.
It's not Leech Lake level, but it's pretty cool. Like, there's a little community here.
Yeah, there's a little community. People, most I believe, in my brief ice fishing experience, it feels as if ice fishing is mostly just standing around drinking. And every once in a while, you look at a rod, like, oh, nothing's happening over there. And then a guy's be like, nah, they're not biting. I'd be like, well, how much work have you done? And it seems like right now we're just sitting around. There's a bunch of dudes just talking. And yeah, fishing maybe is secondary.
Although, you notice I am. I'm continuing to jig.
As we're talking, you are jigging. And if we catch a fish, that might be live. I'll give the live commentary.
Okay.
On your ability to pull these giant things in. What kind of fish are in here so people know what we might be pulling in?
Well, Fort Peck is known for walleye.
Yep.
It's a pretty good walleye fishery. Maybe the second most famous or known fish is northern pike. There's a good smallmouth bass fishery here, but today we are in deep water fishing for lake trout.
Yeah, they've caught a couple big old lake trout here, huh? Before we got here, the guys that were already set up, a couple of big lakes on the ice.
And they're good-looking fish. Man. They're deep. Good. They're
how they eat? They eat well.
Man, they're a little bit fishy, a little bit oily. But smoke them, I mean, they're good.
Put them in the oil, fry them up.
Fry them up.
Always fry them up.
The thing I like about this so far is we haven't gone to the third level of ice fishing, which is you doubt everything. Your lure, you're constantly changing up. Yeah. What's wrong?
Yep.
It's never that.
Well, Steven Ranella has this camera they dropped down, and you can see the fish. He was describing watching the perch just like swim up to the bait and just gently put their mouth on it and then decide, no, and back off. And I feel like that makes you even more paranoid.
Oh,
once you know that the fish are non-committal in the way that they are. So you're like, if I just this different jig, different worm, different weight, different leader.
I wouldn't want that much information. The beauty of ice fishing is you have no idea what's going on down there, so you could just make it up.
Oh, I know. You're like, you know what? I think this is where, it's just about persistence at this juncture, which it often is. But it's the feeling that you get, you know, when you're sitting out on the ice. We don't have any fancy stuff here, but I'm drinking and you're drinking Old Milwaukee Light. This is the American Pinup Series can, you know, not sponsored.
Yeah.
But listen, Old Milwaukee, if you're listening to this, any of you marketing executives or your agency people, hit us up here at the Hunting Collective. We'd love to be sponsored by Old Milwaukee Light. This shit is delicious.
And I kind of feel like we would bring our own new pinup series to it.
Yes. Yeah. Pinup ice fisherman.
Hirsute ice fisherman.
just dudes in fur.
I think your hat. So
yeah.
Ben O'Brien today at the gas station in Glasgow,
yeah,
he comes out with this Dakota Dan hat. I mean,
awesome.
It's like a rabbit, mad rabbit bomber hat.
Yeah.
I thought he'd had it like it was a family heirloom. And he wore it like in that kind of subtle way, like, my great-granddad broke this in.
Yeah, no, I didn't announce that I was putting it on or anything. I just slipped it on. And it during conversation, you must have said that. You certainly got fuzzier in the last 20 minutes.
Yeah, well, part of it was just your Johnny attitude.
Like, yeah, yeah, but my attitude changed immediately.
You wanted me to look at it and notice it,
yeah.
But I didn't put it together that it was a brand-new purchase.
It was only $9.99. Shout out to the Glasgow Jiffy Lube, where the fuck we were. It was a good purchase. It's proven to be it's made in China, of course, but it's proven to be synthetic fur, I imagine, but proven to be a good purchase.
The thing I like about this setup, and you can kind of hear it maybe in the background, the soundtrack to this.
Oh yeah,
we don't need no stinking ice shanty. We don't need
no.
We're out in the elements here. We're literally on our knees. I can't feel my feet below
my... We'll have somebody take a picture of us. It's the saddest podcast ever.
Our backs are to the wind, which isn't helping.
No.
And I'm so distracted by my dog,
yeah,
who is just... We call her the resident dumbass. She
this
just chased the loneliest snow goose in America into the only open water on the lake, and she went in.
She went in. And that water's cold. We thought we were going to have to go over there and rescue her, but Nellie being Nellie, she found her way out of there, man. And she She is standing beside us now, probably waiting to crop dust us. Sets our backs to the wind. You never know. But yeah, I mean, this country, you know, talk a little bit about your home country here, because it is, you know, the Missouri Breaks. It is Fort Peck. I mean, there's some pretty popular names. Like I was saying before we were driving over here, I do feel like Fort Peck is something at least Montanans talk about a good bit. But I mean, I think the Missouri Breaks are something that all hunters understand, you know, as a destination.
I think this is, you know, I moved here 20 years ago, worked for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and I kind of thought this is going to be kind of a fun little hiatus on the way to somewhere else.
Yeah.
And there's a couple things I noticed. One is you nailed it. I mean, these sort of legendary locations, the Missouri River Breaks is, you know, kind of synonymous with big mule deer and elk and bighorn sheep, and it's all real. That is in my backyard. The Milk River is just over our shoulder, which was kind of lost a little bit of its luster, but synonymous with big whitetails.
Oh yeah,
pheasant hunting. I mean, if you're a sportsman, this is a pretty nice place.
What we were talking about back in the day when I was coming up, real tree monster bucks, man. Bill Jordan was out there just bringing like Michael Waddell's coming out here every year and killing bucks, and that's what I knew of. And so when I thought of the Milk River, I thought of this, you know, hallowed ground, this destination that that is, you know, akin to Pike County, Illinois for whitetail. Yeah. You know, it was popularized in that way.
It still is. So the thing that has kept me here is, yeah, there's, to me, it's, as I said to Ben on the way out here, we really don't have an access problem. There's abundant public land. There's block management everywhere. In some ways, it's going back in time to 1950s America, where if you know somebody, certainly if you live here, you get asked if you want to hunt their place. You don't have to ask the locals. They ask you.
Yeah.
That's pretty nice.
That is. Yeah, and it's rolling country. It's Black Hills. It's, you know, river bottoms. You know, the view out your back porch, I said, made me feel like when Captain Woodrow F. Call drove all those cattle from, he's not a real person, he's a fictional character, but he drove all those cattle from Texas to Montana, and he came up on this ridge, and he goes, boys, we're here.
This is the place.
This is it. And your place feels much like that. And, you know, that no people that listen to this podcast know I've waxed about Montana well enough, but this area, I mean, it's such a diverse state. This area just feels a lot different than many that I've spent time in.
Well, now I got to bring in the other part of it. There's a reason there aren't very, very, very many people here. It's a hard place to live. I mean, we've had a tough, long winter. We have long, hot summers with the biggest mosquitoes you've ever seen. The Washington Post just did a analysis of every zip code in the country last year, looking at infrastructure and the distance between towns and services. And they named Glasgow the loneliest town in America when it comes to accessibility to public services. So it's the middle of nowhere. And that can really feel like it sometimes. It's 285 miles to the airport. So you can get to know yourself pretty well in this country.
Let's just repeat that really quick. 285 miles
to the airport.
So anytime anybody listening complains about their airport run, mine's like 5 minutes, more like 5 miles. But I think it's safe to say that this is tough country, man. And it makes for tough people, but hardy and good people too, I find, just from my brief time out here.
The thing I like about it, and also it grieves me a little bit, is it is like the best of 1950s America, where everybody's watching out for you. It's been a great place to raise kids. But it's also the worst of 1950s America, where people are kind of trapped in time in terms of, like, there's not a lot of ethnic diversity or culinary diversity, and everybody knows your business. Everybody knows your business.
Yeah.
I like it, but it makes going to the grocery store kind of a long... You got to prepare for it, because they're going to make small talk for
you're
like 2 hours.
You're going to run into a lot of people. Yeah, I think I yearn for both things, right? I think I yearn for like that small town feel where you know everybody, but I also yearn to be connected and be, you know, in a place where a lot's going on. Like, I yearn for that beehive of activity, but I also at the same time don't want to, you know, pass by a bunch of strangers on the street or go to the grocery store and not know a soul. So there's gives and takes, but you try to find a place where you can get both of those things.
I kind of feel like Bozeman, though, as we were talking. It's like Paris in the 20s. It's like the epicenter right now of a lot of cool stuff. So I think you've actually got that.
Yeah, I think it's close. But so nobody else moved there. It's full. I'm already like that old Montana. This is my favorite. Like, if anybody wants to go and read the reviews of my podcast, there's some one stars in there. There's a couple dozen of those in there. And one guy just wrote, and this is after I had already moved to Montana. State of Montana, it's full, one star. I was like, yeah, well, that's a sound review of this media product.
Well, I don't want to denigrate my hometown too much, but I'll tell you this. So we've lived here. Yeah, we've lived here 19 years. We've raised, my daughter was born here. It will take another 87 years before we're like residents. At least three or four generations. People always say, "Oh, where are you actually from?"
Yeah. Where are you from? You don't sound like you're from here.
Yeah.
I feel like I've got a lot long ways to go. But, you know, in an effort of transition, and speaking of raising kids, your kids are, you know, high school age, right?
Yeah.
And your two twin sons are ready to go off to college. And I think all three of your kids are, you know, hunters at some level, right? I mean, call them all avid hunters, but they certainly live in the Mecca to take up outdoor pursuits. You were, for folks that don't know Andrew's background, you know, you were editor-in-chief at Outdoor Life for how many years prior to?
7 years.
7 years. And have been in the outdoor industry and wildlife management and such for many years prior to that. And so, I mean, you've involved yourself in a lot of, you know, hunter recruitment and hunter retention types of activities and written about it for Outdoor Life and been a part of a lot of editorial products that spoke about it in broad and micro sense, you know. What do you feel like for your kids, their generation, like, what's the, you know, I don't want to call it their plight, but what's their biggest challenge to, you know, maintain what they've got here in Glasgow?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, one of the, I guess, motivators for me being involved in, you know, kind of the greater pass it on movement is, so my daughter's a freshman in high school in Glasgow, Montana. She's 15. She took hunter education when she was 11-year-old, like a lot of Montana kids. It's not, these are not big classes, but I think she's got 50 kids, 55 kids in her grade.
Yeah.
There's only two girls who hunt and maybe three or four boys who hunt. This is impossibly the huntingest town in America.
This is, I would say, this is the Mecca. If anybody thinks of like a place where you have access to a plethora of game, you know, and just a culture that supports it, this is it, man.
So it's not a given that just because you are raised here and maybe your folks have always done this that you're going to. So that was kind of the first thing. It's like we got to really work on that, the funnel, you know, the throat of the funnel and getting more kids involved in it. But then I started looking at my buddies in the generation above me. Hell, there's a couple of them out here on the ice we just saw. They don't do it much anymore.
Yeah.
They're aging out. And so the big kind of the national perspective is tying those two things together. We're an aging population. All the statistics say at about age 66, you just don't do this much anymore.
Yeah.
Even though you may have the interest and you know, maybe now the financial ability and the time to do it, you just don't have the physical desire to do it. And so the big problem is we're not replacing ourselves as we age out with a new generation coming in.
Yeah, it's the baby boomer issue, right?
Yeah, right.
It's the, you know, that world post World War II boom in hunters, and we're in the decline.
And I think this is no news to anybody. There's been a concern about it for a long time, which is why there have been all the kids programs that state agencies and the NGOs think about, the Turkey Federation's Jake's program.
Yep.
Like, oh, we got to work on really making it attractive to kids. The fallacy with that whole thing has been, and I've participated in this fallacy myself, is typically you think about kids who go to like a field day for a Turkey Federation. Mm-hmm. They're the kids of the parents who are already involved in that.
Yeah.
Those are the most likely kids to be involved as a family tradition. And so I don't think it follows that kids, just because they're exposed to it, are going to do it. There's just a lot of distractions, a lot of other choices that they have.
Yeah, and I think it comes to, like, there's another part of it, another part of the dichotomy is very much that And I was this way to some extent. I don't know if your kids will be this way. We'll see. But, you know, your parents teach you hunting. Your dad is normally the way that that goes. But, you know, somebody in your family or some close friend becomes your mentor, teaches you hunting. And then you turn 18, you go to high school, you discover the opposite sex. You discover parties. You discover other things, sports.
Old Milwaukee Light.
Shout out to Old Milwaukee Light. Hashtag pinup can American Series. Hashtag not sponsored. this shit is good. But I think I dropped off during college a good bit because I had a job. I had an internship. I was taking a full course, 12 credit, 3 courses. And I dropped off of hunting, at least as, you know, when I wasn't with my dad. So the danger is that's we focus on the youth, right? We got to get them in. Well, we got to retain them too, right?
You bet.
We got to keep them in. And so I think that's something that is starting to be recognized as well, because there's a lot of drop off.
Well, you think about kids too. I mean, there may be that avidity. There's not a lot of other things in their lives, but you start to think about how to build a self-perpetuating machine.
Yeah.
Kids don't have disposable income. They don't have disposable time. They don't have disposable transportation. So they're totally dependent. And so you're exactly right. What we're looking at.
Yeah, explain. Let's explain R3 and kind of your involvement in it and give people an idea of what's going on.
This isn't an isolated, you know, thought that we've got to do something to really perpetuate these traditions. And we can kind of talk about what's dependent on that perpetuation. It's the entire funding structure for wildlife management in America. Yeah. Is participants fund wildlife management, game wardens,
yeah,
the whole system. And so once we start to see big drop-off, there's meaningful impacts, yeah, in terms, yeah, of there's not enough funding to get this stuff done.
Well, they'll say most. I think the average is, this changes, so this is not a direct stat that I'm quoting, but it's around 60% of most state agencies' funding comes from tags and Pittman-Robertson type funds.
Yeah.
You know, excise tax type revenues. And so that's a huge number. And that's, like I said, that's all dependent on these user groups going out and buying licenses and spending the money and doing the things that's required to go hunting. So we've created this system that's beautiful and is beautifully intertwined, but it also, you know, hinges on participation.
So there have been a lot of demographic studies and just looking at kind of cultural changes over time that have taken the national look at this and said, okay, so there's the throat of the funnel we talked about. That's the recruitment side. There's the retention side, which is if you've started hunting, like you in college, like an awful lot of people, how do we bring these people back and kind of keep them in the fold?
Yeah.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. Hey, if you guys like to cook outdoors, and you oughta, you should check out the Weber Slate Rust Resistant Griddle. Now, this is a good innovation here, and it solves a real problem, okay? So this is a carbon steel cooktop that's safe for metal tools, like a griddle on your grill. It's pre-seasoned with food-safe oils and ready to cook on right out of the box. There's no use of coatings, okay? You can use metal tools to flip, press, and scrape without worry. It's the griddle that stays ready, not rusty. Now, the problem with griddles, everything rusts. No one talks about how bad everything rusts. The reason they don't, because they couldn't fix it until now. Well, Weber's new rust-resistant technology, your Weber grill will last for years. When used, the carbon steel griddle hardens and bonds the surface, reducing the ability for moisture to collect and rust to form. With the new Weber Works Prep Cook and Store system, you can keep cooking and cleaning supplies handy, carry food and condiments from the kitchen to the griddle, and even convert the side table into a prep station. Get fired up for your new Weber Slate rust-resistant griddle. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
Yeah, I mean, and the term, you know, where did the term, like R3 is the term that we, that was coined. Something I think people need to know, and it's more of an industry term, but take people through where that first started and kind of where you first heard it and what you think of that model, or at least that articulation of the needs for that funnel.
So just to be clear, R3 is, so it's recruitment, retention, and then reactivation. And that's that idea that you may have had some exposure to this at some point in your life. You fell out of it. How do we bring those people back in? So we're not starting from scratch with a whole bunch of new people who have to understand, you know, the value of wildlife and the tradition of in America. So those are the three R's. I didn't really hear about it in terms of like almost kind of branding campaign. And yeah. So just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it's very recent.
And like a lot of these things, I'm an agency alum and veteran, but agencies drive me crazy for a couple of reasons. One, they coined things like this R3 movement. Well, it's not a movement until people make a difference with it. You can't just say it's going to happen and then
it's just gonna, words.
It's just a bunch of words.
They did make like a nice logo, I believe. But it's just words. But I guess it's words that like a concept that we can agree with, but it's the concept in action, right, as you say.
And honestly, reactivation is kind of clunky. Yeah. So if I had to say maybe it's two R's and then maybe we find another word for
a
that
U
one.
Or something.
Maybe a Y.
R or Y.
The other thing that drives you crazy about state agencies is they want to just study everything to death and then prove the concept, which is the scientific method. I get it. It's how we manage lots of our wildlife. But the human dimension of what we do kind of resists that sometimes. And so one of my foundational principles about this is our ability to recruit, retain, and reactivate people may not work the same in Illinois or New York or Montana. It's going to be a little bit different. But we can sit here as people who care about it and study it for 15 or 20 years. In that time, the world isn't standing still waiting for our conclusions.
No.
Let's just do some stuff. Yeah. Let's just kind of do it. But state agencies are kind of resistant to that idea.
Yeah, they have to act on. I mean, it's governmental action campaign. But let's just see if this works. But we have to have a study and a basis on which to act.
But one of the reasons I think we need to act is because, demographics wait for no man.
Yeah.
Our baby boomers are leaving the fold. We're not replacing ourselves very well. But here's the interesting, I think exciting thing is, think about that continuum of kids who didn't have the disposable time or income. People who do, I think, are the most energetic and source of greatest potential. And that's the, you know, the 25-year-old college graduate who's really looking for something in their life to give a meaning and something to do, something to join. I think the local food movement has probably been the best thing that's happened to this. And really the whole idea of the outdoors is being an authentic experience. Nobody is going to sugarcoat it for you. You can have a mentor or somebody to guide you, but ultimately you're kind of on your own. You're going to find out a lot about yourself out in the elements. And I think that's actually the most exciting thing. I look at it almost as like a new homestead movement.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it too, because you know, it's cultivating this willingness to, you know, charge ahead and fail and start again. And it's not, you know, I think some of the fallacies in our current media space is that there's this like focus on the success, right? You got like, you can't have a TV show without a dead animal. You can't have, the more dead critters you get on your social media, the more likes you're going to get just by nature of the way that it works. But, and that, those things are all great. And that's a depiction of what we do. You're not going to erase, you know, those things, but at some level.
Get my dog Nelly back.
Nelly!
Old Nelly the dumbass. She's kind of a coyote. She's a forager.
She's a forager.
She's going from ice hole to ice hole looking for bait.
Looking for bait, looking for the occasional fishtail. Our neighbors are packing up, getting out of town.
Why do I suddenly feel so alone out here?
We like everybody left us. It was a great podcast. We had to walk home. Nelly!
Come on, Nelly.
Come on, Nelly. Come here now. Here she comes.
Kinda. She's skulking her way toward us.
Yeah, whatever. I'll come back. I like these ice fishing interludes. Hopefully we get an interlude where there's a fish on.
Fish
there,
so on!
I'm looking over back at my hole. My hole looks like it's doing good. but yeah, I mean, I think we talk about this, and I've talked about this a lot, but it's important to note that we talk about this. We would be proactive on it even if we weren't in the situation we're in. Nelly's back. Nelly.
Right here, kid.
Nelly!
Come here.
Go over here. There you go. We would be talking about it even if we were in a healthy situation, I think. But we wouldn't be, I don't think we would be as active and as, you know, we should be desperate in a lot of ways to stem the tides.
It's interesting, though. You kind of hit on this. I think we all who are define our lives by what we do understand it through and through. There's no shortcuts. You earn what you put into it. It's kind of a feedback loop that way.
Yeah.
I think there's been a tendency, we talked about kind of giving kids all these opportunities. You see it in youth seasons, all these other things too. There's a real tendency to say, okay, we want to open the gate for a bunch of new participants. We have to make it as easy and as accessible as possible. I actually think that's the wrong approach.
Yeah.
Because I think the value of this is it is hard. It can't be so hard it's intimidating. There has to be success, but there also has to be a little bit of a challenge that boosts the reward as the outcome when it finally happens.
Yeah. And that's why I think introducing things like small game to the equation, right? If you're there's, you know, a lot of folks that listen to this that are new hunters and have written in or chatted with me about the challenges of being a new hunter, and there are many challenges, but there also are many doors that are hanging wide open for you to walk through. You just have to do it. And yeah. Don't get caught up in the dogmas of hunting that you got to go out and kill a big old elk or a big old whitetail.
Right.
So that's what I think the revitalization of small game hunting. I have more fun, as much fun hunting cottontails or squirrels or running around the woods with my friends as I do anything else. So, I mean, there certainly is so much value in that I think it's coming back. I mean, we might have lost it as a culture a little bit for a while, but I think it's coming back.
Oh, I think it is. I am so optimistic about it. But I think there's some structural things, too. So if you accept that the activity itself can be a challenge, getting into it shouldn't be. So one of the things I really work on is like trying to simplify state regulations. And this, the gateway to participation doesn't have to be as hard as it is.
Yeah.
Because the activity itself, you're going to find your own way, and it can be a struggle. But at least let's get people to the table and to the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of work that we can do there. Really as a community of citizens to say, okay, we want to perpetuate this. I want my kids to come back home or to make this a part of their lives that perpetuates my tradition to their great-grandkids and great-great-grandkids. It's an important thing to me. There are ways to make it easier.
Yeah.
I think the other thing, too, is I look at our community of people who love this, define their lives by it. There are things that we can do. We need to be passing it on to just people who don't look like us, people in our neighborhoods who may express an interest, share our gear, share our time, share our knowledge. We as a community of people are kind of hoarders. We hoard our secret spots. We hoard our gear. We hoard a lot of stuff. I think over time, we need to start to break that open. We need to share a lot more. That's a hard, I mean, that's a big push for a lot of people.
Yeah. And it seems like as you speak about it in these like broad generalities, it seems, you know, it may seem a little bit shallow, but and a little bit pedantic or whatever, but to me, it's as important a conversation as to have. And you and I were talking not long ago about doing it on a small level, right? So two examples that I've, you know, kind of watched over as long as we've known each other, and then something we talked about the other day. One would be how you've brought your kids up, right? And you've written about that in Outdoor Life and covered it there. One of the favorite things you ever did was Iris Hunt,
yeah,
which was your daughter. Well, it's her first hunting adventures. And so it's that, like, it's talking about that experience in a human way, right? It's a human interest. Like, how is this delivered from this little girl? And how does she go through it? And the other one is, like, the return to the movement for local stewardship, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, we were talking about the local rod and gun club.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The other day. So these are very different things. Nelly is...
That's the new pinup girl right there.
Get him, Nelly. Hey, girl. So those are the two things from you that... I really wanted to know about, because, you know, one is just the narrative of you and Iris, and your two twin sons, how that worked for you and your personal experience. But then greater, how do you feel like on a local level we can get back to just caring about our community and using that as a way to express hunting and fishing? And I think that's a more personal thing for people to talk about rather than just talk about these broad 11 million this and 12 million that.
Absolutely. I think that just puts people to sleep. Nobody gets the scale of things.
People listen to this like a couple of dudes on their knees on the ice.
Wind howling.
Just talking about some bullshit. But there's personal things that happen that, you know, shape the way you think about hunting.
It's funny, like, I mean, I'm a dad of three kids. My boys are twins. It was an easy thing to kind of take them and introduce them to things. But my daughter has had an aptitude for this for a long, long time. But I mentioned, you know, there's not a big tradition of her peer group. It's kind of funny. She's a kid who's looking for... Well, that's a good look right there. It looks like a bunch of Okies headed to California.
Holy shit. Now... We have to describe what just drove by. It's three dudes on a four-wheeler sitting on top of a cooler. Each one has a beer in their hand. They got an auger strapped to the front. They got an ice sled on the back full of buckets of ice fishing gear. And they're just trying. It's like a parade float.
It kind of looks to me like a mobile garage sale.
Yeah. It looks like maybe – it looks like, you know, how the wagon train in the West – two of those dudes will die before they reach their destination. God,
one will
wonderful.
Be eaten.
That's a Milwaukee Light commercial that just drove by us, those boys.
I'm so surprised Nelly didn't join that.
Geez.
Just because it looked...
I kind of want to join it.
I did
too. Looks like a...
There was not room for us.
No. In many ways, there's not room for us there. But anyhow, you're raising your kids.
So yeah, so to me, I knew this was something that we were going to do anyway. So that was easy, but it's... It was easy in the sense of we have the place to do it, and it was, to me, a little bit of a laboratory. The harder thing to me was, this is a hard thing to say, because it's going to sound, you said pedantic.
I said pedantic in a podcast.
You said
what a
pedantic,
douche.
Yeah. And I think it was about me.
There was a,
I winced
no, there
a
was
little.
A, there was, you know, there's shallow and pedantic. That came from a comedy. I can't remember the particular one.
I actually think it's easy as hell to teach your own kids these things. What's hard is somebody else's kids or somebody who doesn't have the same origin point as you do. As we, through the Outdoor Life piece, started thinking about how do we talk about making a difference and making this scale. Because it's one thing to one-to-one is how most of us learn how to hunt. It's with a parent or an uncle or a family friend. It doesn't scale very well.
No.
If you think about, we're trying to make a big global difference, or at least national difference, you've got to figure out a way to replicate yourself more than just once. And so at Outdoor Life, one of our projects was to figure out ways that we could expand the footprint of just one person.
Yeah.
You know, the NGOs have done it pretty well with field days and all that stuff. We just talked about how kind of shallow that is. So we actually talked about, what if each of us take three people out? Yeah. The foundational principle for this is, if somebody expresses an interest in hunting and asks you to take them hunting and you don't do it, you're an asshole.
Yeah, don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
Yeah.
The problem with that is, if 15 people all express that and you're committed not to be an asshole, you don't have time for yourself anymore.
Yeah. So what's like the asshole threshold?
To me, it's three people a year.
That's pretty good, man.
It's pretty good.
Three people hunting a year.
But you got to think about it. Now, if that's your filter too, you could actually be a little selective because if you're depending to scale this up, now you can sort of pick and choose people who are going to replicate your experience to another generation of people. This is kind of the classic pyramid scheme,
right? Yes, that's right. Influence the influencers, as they like to say.
Now, to me, that's the secret for this whole thing. I think there's enough people who have an interest.
Yeah.
This is the recruitment part of the R.
Yes.
Like, find people who are going to follow on with this and follow through with this. Wait, what?
What?
Are, wait a minute. We just had a little visitation here. They're pulling out fish galore.
Chester from RER Bows, he's coming. Are we getting, what is that for? Is that for us? Fuck yeah, man.
Flopping fish.
We're going to eat. We'll eat them.
Thanks, brother.
Come over to the office. We'll cook them up for you. No, this is a perfect part of the podcast. You made it on. You made it on the podcast as the deliverer of fish. Well done, man.
So a snowmobile just rolled. Is it rolled? Sluiced up to
What's
us.
What's it do? Yeah, it's like slides a little. Like
slide, maybe treaded up.
Propelled. Was propelled. And out flopped a couple of big Lakers.
And Nelly, Nelly, those are not for you.
They're not for you.
She's convinced there was been a faction on the ice.
I feel like there's every serious conversation about hunter recruitment should be interspersed with like random visits from fucking snowmobiles and stuff. That's the way it ought to be. But back to what.
So, pick your people who are going to pass it on. The thing I did this past year and the going kind of community thing is, we have a local sporting group called the Highline Sportsmen. It's not associated with any critter group or anything. It's just a bunch of us middle of nowhere-ers who really like to work together, and we really like to fish and hunt. And we realized that the big critter groups were leaving out a lot of little small conservation missions. Like, right, they're saving habitat for turkeys and pheasants and stuff, but what about like the habitat for humans, for people? And so one of the things we took on, I was kind of an evangelist about this whole mentor thing, and so we all as a group said, we're each going to take out one person. That's the way to scale it right there, too.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people in this town, even though we don't have an access problem, we got game all around us, who don't have an experience of hunting or fishing. And so each of us who were able to took out one, two, and even three people. And that's where I was saying, that's the hard thing. Because these people, they don't have their own gear, so you're sharing their gear. They don't have a place, so you're sharing your place. And they don't have, they're sharing your time, too. To me, that was the heaviest lift of all. But holy cologne, it was also the most rewarding of all to see these people who have never hunted or fished before holding up a gigantic back quarter of a mule deer that they just killed.
I mean,
they're
going
to take home and feed their families.
It's just, what's this person going right here? What's this lonely walker going across the ice?
I see Nelly taking them down.
No, the funny thing is, you know, like you would say, this is this great, you know, philanthropic thing you're doing there. But it really is as rewarding for the mentor as it is for the mentee. Like, it is. And it's like
it
a personal, I love it, man. I love doing it. I've done it several times, not three a year, which I need to start. But, that you know, there's something in it for the mentor. I mean, there really is. And it makes you a better hunter because you see it through the eyes of someone that's never, like, seen it. It opens it up to you.
I think that's actually a huge part of it I hadn't thought about till right now. It made me a much more aware hunter because you're trying to maximize the success of the whatever mentee. We've had a hard time figuring out what to call
mentee.
It's not really an apprentice. Mentee sounds like
someone that's swimming around in Florida. Or maybe like a mint.
So whatever that apprentice is, you know, you want them to have a good time. And I think this is the other thing. They have to have success.
Oh, yeah.
Going out and just seeing game is not enough. Going out and just smelling the earth and being part of nature, that ain't enough. They've got to have at least the chance to pull the trigger.
Yeah. 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 And you take away the constructs for those of us who have hunted a long time and feel like we're pursuing like the bigger the animal, the better. You know, if you could strip that away a little bit, that's helped me in the past see that, like, man, I had the greatest time. All we did was shoot a javelina, and all we did was cook up a javelina. But it was one of the greatest days I've had running around outside. And like, all we did was shoot a mess of squirrels. But it's the greatest day I've had in a long damn time.
Yeah.
And then you start to learn that, like, if I would just get out of my own way in a lot of these cases, I'd be fine. You know, if I would just
that's exactly right.
Just get out that's of your exactly own damn right. way. And that, but those people don't know how to get in their way. All they're trying to do is go right foot, left foot, right foot, left foot.
But the cool thing is, so I took these three people out last year, and my kids participated too, which
that's awesome.
It was really neat for my kids to be part of that whole thing. They took them out occasionally too, and it doesn't stop there. So this spring in Montana, there's a window of opportunity to put in for special permits. So these people I introduced to hunting last year are like, okay, I'm ready to take the next step. Where do I put in for elk? Like, hell yeah. That's the way it's supposed to work.
Hell yeah.
Now, I'm not giving away my spot.
No, you'd be like,
two
no,
times in a row.
You got to work for it, you son of a bitch. You get out there and you tell me where to go next year. But yeah, it's there's something about it too. So like if you're able to, man, it'll change, not only change the person that you're with, but it'll change you.
I teach hunter education here, and you know, for all of the listeners, if you don't teach hunter ed, I encourage you to, because it's an easy lift. It's easy to do. Every state agency is looking for volunteers to help teach this. This is really just an extension of that.
Yeah.
But one of the things I notice in hunter education, we talk about the stages of a hunter, right? You know, there's the beginner who just wants to shoot. There's the limit filler who just wants to fill whatever limit is available. Then there's the method. There's the trophy hunter. There's also, you know, at the end of the road, there's the philosopher hunter or whatever. I think this is the perfect manifestation of that philosopher hunter.
Yeah.
What I notice is I feel like there's a lot of people in our world who get exposed to this R3 discussion who are like, I know I should do it. I feel bad that I don't. I don't think you should. It's the sort of thing that at some point in your trajectory as a hunter or a sportsman, this is going to come to you and you're going to do it. If you're not doing it now, don't worry about it. But just be aware that your work is needed. When you're ready, there's going to be there's going to be demand.
We were talking the other day about podcasting, right? You're involved in it. A lot of, like, pretty much everybody that has the capability nowadays is involved in it. And that doesn't mean, you know, the fact that you can do it doesn't mean you have something to say. And, if you would have talked to me 6 or 7 years ago when I first heard about podcasting, had I started one, I wouldn't have had a whole lot to say. Yeah. And that grows, right? So it's the same kind of thing.
It's like
when you're ready and you feel confident and you've codified your ideas and the way that you hunt and you've, done all the work that you had to do, then you can open yourself up to give into other people in different ways. But you don't have to force yourself into it. And man, I would love, for me, moving into Montana, to teach hunter safety, have my wife and son come, have my wife cook, big casserole for everybody, and we'll teach hunter safety and hang out. Like, that would be a great way to spend my life. And I'm sure I would enjoy the hell out of that. When I don't have little kids, I'll probably be better suited, So like,
it's a time of life.
Yeah, it's a time of life for sure.
One of the things people ask about all the time is like, what's the playbook for this? Like, how do I actually do it? How do I break it down? I think one of the things that is magical about hunting and fishing and being an outdoors person is there ain't no playbook. You make it up as you go along, but I also think that's the great beauty of it. It makes it hard to replicate, though, because it's a handmade thing. Your ability to teach somebody is not a mass production. You give and you take in pretty small increments. All right, that frustrates the ability to scale this for sure.
Yes.
But I think also the intimate relationships, when you're with one other person in the field, there's no looking away. There's no, escape ground. And so you're kind of forced to face a lot of things.
Yep.
Whether it's your own lack of knowledge about things, your own lack of experience.
That's a huge point you just made. Like, when you're walking around, and this has happened to me several times, you're walking around in the woods with someone who's never been in the woods, and they are asking questions, the simplest questions, and you've never thought of these simple questions. Like, you could say exactly how and why an elk might be standing in that spot that he's in, but you can't tell him. You can't say the tree that he's under or the type of grass that he's munching on, or understand what a riparian corridor is, or, explain the taxonomy. Like, there's things that they'll ask that you realize, holy shit, I skipped over that and went right to the mechanics of my compound bow. And so those things are, it's not a problem. Like,
you know, everybody has those knowledge holes. All of us do. Nobody's perfect. But it's nice to have somebody to like open that up to you and realize that, man, I need to, you know, if I'm going to teach my son, I need to be able to tell him what that elk's eating, why they're eating it, why it's growing there, why it was growing over there, where they bed, where, you know, and those things are important and enriching for the, you know, the veteran hunter who just doesn't, hasn't seen it in that way. Because I know, I don't know if you do, but I know a lot of hunters that can get you to that elk and call that elk and make sure you kill it better than anybody, but couldn't tell you any of the things I just described.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I think it widens the aperture in many ways, in many good ways. No fish.
Oh, no. I'm jigging like a mofo over
here,
though.
You're jigging the
I mean, you know,
we got ice on the line.
I mean, I keep feeling like I have fish because my line weighs so much now with accumulated ice, but
we're not gonna get there. But tell people, describe a little bit about your hunt with Iris and, like, you know, from her eyes. Like you said, she doesn't have or doesn't have a peer group of you know, young lady hunters running around with her. So, you know, you're kind of, through her, doing a little Trojan horse activity into the local population.
So I think everybody who has a kid or even somebody that may take hunting for the first time is going to be familiar with this. But, like, as the teacher, you want success so bad.
Yeah.
You want it to happen. One of the interesting things with my daughter is, so she's a good shot. She's super safe with guns. She's pretty knowledgeable about wildlife and where to find them. What I didn't recognize is she's also a total school marm when it comes to ethics and waiting for the perfect shot. Yeah. The biggest problem for me, and I still actually see it with her, I mean, now she's 15. We've got four seasons under our belt. Now, of course, she's become this trophy hunter, not just any deer will do. It's like, what have I done here?
Yeah.
What have I done with Nellie? She's heading over to an entire different camp.
Oh, Nellie.
That's fine. I'm sure we'll see her again.
She'll make it back. She made it out of the ice earlier. So she's made it from harder.
So, you know, as a mentor or somebody who's teaching, you kind of get these small victories. Okay, we've in this case, we were hunting deer. We found the deer. We've executed a great stalk. Here's this shot we've set up. We've kind of waited. What we as experienced hunters recognize is, when the stars align and everything is right, we act on it.
Yeah.
What we forget is we can kind of see when that shot is perfect.
Yes.
What a young hunter, a beginning hunter, doesn't see is their expectation of perfection is different than ours. They think perfection is going to last forever. And they have all kinds of time to kind of get settled and get their breathing right. I bet with Iris's first hunt, we had five or six excellent shot opportunities. And it was perfect. It was perfect for an uncountable fraction of a second when we as experienced sportsmen know that's when you take it. And she would wait too long, and then it would become imperfect, and she couldn't take the shot. So that was actually a source of great frustration. I had no ability to articulate that to her. I'm like, why didn't you shoot? And I would just, you know, I kind of lose my shit a little bit. What I recognize now is that's actually part of the learning curve, too, is to say, hey, when things are right, they're right. And you have to have the confidence of perception to act when things are right.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that takes a long time in the evolution of a sportsman.
Oh, yeah. Well, we were talking about that on the drive up here with a couple of guys from Mediator about the intersection of, like, your ability to make the shot and the opportunity. Like, that's the sweet spot. It's not that you're just looking, like, the first opportunity you get, you just pull the trigger, or the first time, or you're going to wait till you're 10 yards away from an animal and shoot it every time. It's the cross section between, you know, the intersection, that sweet spot of I have the right opportunity and I have the ability to make that opportunity, to turn that opportunity into success. And that's, I think, what people struggle with throughout their hunting careers. So, what, you know, why wouldn't it be that way in the first shot?
Well, we have the accumulated knowledge to know that those fleeting moments may not happen again.
Yeah.
So it really kind of puts that emphasis on it. You better take it when it happens. If you're a beginning hunter, you think this happens every day, all day. So why be in a hurry? Why really emphasize that intersection?
And that's right. I mean, I think it's, you know, you watch kids, you watch their eyes, man. You just watch their facial expressions. And when I was a kid, I missed three deer, wounded a deer, and then had a rifle cartridge not go off on another deer, which I don't think I've ever had. I haven't had since then. And so it was like my sixth try I got a deer. And this is rifle hunting, you know. And none of those deer were more than 75 yards away, but I was 12 years old. And so I think I was in that situation too. I thought, well, every time, this is over like a 2 or 3 day period. I'm like, every time you go out, you get 2 or 3 chances at a deer. You know, so next one will come by. Next one will come by. And you with perspective, with learning, you learn that perspective. That's not always the case, man.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. Hey, if you guys like to cook outdoors, and you oughta, you should check out the Weber Slate Rust Resistant Griddle. Now, this is a good innovation here, and it solves a real problem, okay? So this is a carbon steel cooktop that's safe for metal tools, like a griddle on your grill. It's pre-seasoned with food-safe oils and ready to cook on right out of the box. There's no use of coatings, okay? You can use metal tools to flip, press, and scrape without worry. It's the griddle that stays ready, not rusty. Now, the problem with griddles, everything rusts. No one talks about how bad everything rusts. The reason they don't, because they couldn't fix it until now. Well, Weber's new rust-resistant technology, your Weber grill will last for years. When used, the carbon steel griddle hardens and bonds the surface, reducing the ability for moisture to collect and rust to form. With the new Weber Works Prep Cook and Store system, you can keep cooking and cleaning supplies handy, carry food and condiments from the kitchen to the griddle, and even convert the side table into a prep station. Get fired up for your new Weber Slate rust-resistant griddle. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth.
But Iris got a deer eventually, huh?
Iris got a deer. She had said, oh, and this is the other thing, like she borrows this from my dad, who actually, he came out here to Eastern Montana. He had a cow elk tag. We got permission to hunt this ranch where it was full of cow elk. And I said, hey, Dad, what's your effective range? He's like, 300 yards. I'm like, all right, that's great. No problem. We got 12 cows at 308 yards, and I'm waiting for my dad to shoot. He wouldn't shoot. The cow elk started drifting away. I'm like, Dad, why didn't you shoot? He's like, well, they weren't at 300 yards.
That's badass.
So Iris inherited this thing from my dad. It was like, hey, 200 yards is her effective range. She was hunting with a 243.
Yeah.
We had blown opportunities inside of 200 yards. Finally, we had one at 240, and she was not going to take the shot, which I greatly admired her for. Finally, when things were lined up, she took the shot at like 270 yards with a 243 and dropped a young mule deer buck with one shot. So our first season was a great success. You can actually check it out. Look at Iris Hunts, and there's a whole video series on this whole thing.
It's great, yeah. It's some of the best writing I've ever read in the outdoor space. I mean, it is fantastic. It'll bring a tear to your eye.
But, you know, you asked her last night what she was thinking about doing, you know, in terms of like a career. She's a freshman in high school. What does she know?
Yeah, it was a bad question. I got challenged for even asking it. But it's relevant, I guess.
I think this tells you a little bit about the potential effectiveness of this R3 stuff. To bring it back to that, is she defined herself right then, and she wants to be a wildlife biologist or a veterinarian, something to do with both the outdoors and wildlife.
Yeah.
And don't discount that. It was actually a pretty good question. It'll change.
Yeah.
I'm sure it will. But that's something that is like has helped define who she is from those early experiences.
Yeah. And that's you know, you want to help to like give your kids the room to have those experiences. And I think hunting and fishing do that. It just does. And it's if done correctly, of course, or if, you know, if done within the responsibility of, you know, a good family and, you know, just good ethics and good moralities. Like those things, it doesn't like give kids perspective. And I've said on this podcast before, it's like a three-dimensional perspective, right? Because if you just take them to the dam, if you're like, hey, I'm going to take you to the amusement park and you'll get to ride all the rides. That's just, you go up, and you come, you get an experience, you come down, and there's nothing that came from it other than the experience. This is different. You have an experience. It's fun. It's kind of like the roller coaster ride. There's ups and downs and there's emotions and such. But then those emotions turn into reality when you pull the trigger and you kill something. And the benefit you get is the meat and taking part in conservation, those types of things. Those are the byproducts of what's there. So it's the ultimate, you know, hate to say gift, but it is. I mean, to give to someone.
Well, you have been a big part of, I think, kind of changing the conversation around what a trophy is. You know, originally, you know, trophy is all about me and this ego stand behind big antlers. You know, I think you've done a masterful job of changing the conversation. It's actually, here's a trophy picture. It's me with a backstrap or a haunch. And this is the trophy parts of an animal. To me, that next step is when I see a trophy picture, it's you with somebody else.
Yes.
You've passed it on. That's the trophy, is this experience that you've given somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've started to, like, that's a filter that I've started to look at those field pictures as, like, two people sharing an experience is a trophy moment.
Yeah, man. It is. And it you know, when we started doing, I've got lots of pushback, like, you hate fun. You hate smiles. You hate America. And I just say, look, highlighting, you know, one expression of the byproduct of hunting is fine. We should continue to highlight all the expressions of hunting that are good, whether it's like time you spent with your family or, you know, your relationship with your dog that is running across the ice now, looking guilty.
Looks so guilty. She clearly got into somebody's bait bucket.
We gotta. Oh, Nelly, no. If we stop, if this podcast stops right now, you'll know that Nelly knocked the recorder into the ice hole. That's the end of the podcast.
What do you call my dog?
Huh?
What do you call my dog?
Nelly.
An ice hole?
An ice hole. Damn ice hole. Jeez. I thought maybe I was calling her the wrong name this whole time or something.
you looked at me with these saucer pan eyes. Like, what? Well, what have I done?
What's her name? Her name is not Nelly. I've done that before. I worked with a young lady at Yeti and called her the wrong name for about 3 years. So that's what I get.
By the way, I can no longer feel my feet below my knees.
Oh, yeah. We can stand up.
I might need a hand.
Oh, God. Oh, sweet.
You want to be a mentor? Help me out.
Come on. I'm the younger of the two of us. I can't stand up.
I literally can't stand.
Stand.
Wait, I got to get my legs went to sleep. All right, there we go. Oh, yeah. That's generational right there.
Well, you're truly, soon you'll only be able to be a mentor. You can't stand up. This has been very unsuccessful and fishing trip. Man, I freaking love this lake.
Look at this.
It's unbelievable place.
Middle of nowhere. Unbelievable.
There's no way I could use my phone to take a picture of this that would do it any justice at all, unfortunately. But it is beautiful. It's beautiful. Well, if there's one thing you had to tell people about how to manage new hunters or how to bring people along, what would you say? Like, is there any boilerplate, like, one line that helps people understand?
I mean, this is going to sound just so underwhelming.
Just do it.
Just do it. I mean, that's no shit.
Like, I was
just
thinking the same thing.
I mean, it can be intimidating. The idea is way more intimidating, I'll guarantee it, than the action. Just do it. It's an extension of what you do already and who you are already. Yeah. I'm convinced of it.
Let's leave it right there. No. Yeah. Just do it.
Just do it.
We came up with that. No one else has ever said that. No companies have ever said that. We might make a hashtag. All right. So there's this thing I'm doing where I'm trying to test out segments, right? Because that's what a lot of people have, segments. Right. I've never had them, but I'm starting to test some out. So I got a couple of segments I'm going to throw at you. No preparation at all. The first one is called Hotspot Cool Dude. That's what I call it.
Uh-huh.
And it's about where I try to convince you to give up one of your hotspots.
Because I'm a cool dude?
Because you're, well, you would be if you give it up.
I see. Yeah.
See what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, you live in this country with all kind of access. Would you be willing to give the listeners of the Hunting Collective your one of your best hunting or fishing spots? Just tell them exactly where it is and how they get to it. Are you willing to do
Absolutely
that?
Absolutely, I am.
Well, you're, okay. God, I thought I'd have to like convince you or something. No? You're willing to do it. All right. Give it to us. Give it to us.
All right. So, one of the really cool dynamics over the last 10 years has been dove season in Montana.
Oh, yeah.
So I think what's happened on a continental basis is there's grain is being planted way farther north in Canada than it ever has been. So it used to be September 1st, we'd have a big cold front. We'd lose all the doves that we had. September 1st, dove opener. What's happened now, September 1st happens, we lose our local doves, but we get all of Canada's doves here in northeast Montana. So the dove hunting here can be like Alabama good.
Oh, really?
I'm not shitting you. For about 2 weeks. Come to Glasgow.
Yep.
Get a block management map for Region 6, and there's a block management area called the Herd, H-U-R-D. It's just out of Glasgow, about a mile and a half. It's on a county road. There's the best. It's gonna be the best dove hunt you've ever had.
Son of a bitch! You just gave them exactly where they gotta go.
And if you, and if the herd is full of people who are listening to this podcast, right across the gravel road is called the Spaniard BMA. Go there.
Go there. And hopefully, if it is full, that means people actually listen to this, which is good, or bad, depending if that's your spot. If you just gave
I've lost angry listeners. I've been exiled from the Highline Sportsman.
Listen, the Highline Sportsman, listen up here now. He's giving away a dove spot. That is, like, that's, you know, the appropriate entry-level hotspot giveaway right there.
I was hoping you'd like that tactical advantage there. I mean, it's a great spot, but it's also good for about 2 weeks.
Yeah, the larger the animal, the more the hotspot is protected, I feel.
Is
that right? Because it's the more meat you're going to get.
But hey, you asked, I gave.
Cool dude, man. Cool dude. That's good. I like that segment. I thought maybe I'd have to, like, really...
Get me down and tickle me?
Yeah. Or offer you some kind of reward or something. But that, I'm glad that you gave that. So go dove hunting.
Go dove
block
hunting.
Block management unit. Come to Glasgow. If you ever happen to be coming to Glasgow, maybe see a Glasgow Scotties game or something like that. The other one, because I know if you've been in this situation, the other segment.
God, tell me that's not a dog training question.
No. The other one is called Damn Near Died. This is the other segment I came up with. And I made these names up myself, so people, you can write in and tell me how stupid they are, or if they're funny and smart. This one is like where you might have almost died somewhere outside. And I know you have a specific thing where you're going to be thinking what I'm thinking. A specific story of where you were in a survival situation. I want to hear about it.
Oh, this one, I mean, it's going to be disappointing, but it was pretty damn scary.
Yeah.
In Montana. Antelope season.
Uh-huh.
There's a block. Another. I hunt some block management.
You're a block
management
hunting some beef.
North of Hysham is called Froze to Death Creek.
Uh-huh.
And the next range over is called Starved to Death Creek, which should tell you something about the desolation of the country. I was hunting with my buddy Steve. He shot an antelope, and the pickup was about 8 miles away on this ridge. As we're taking care of the antelope field dressing, I realized there was a road way closer to us on the other side. All I had to do was go by and pick up 8 miles away. Drive all the way around and get on this other road, and geez, we could just drag the antelope right to it. So I did. I couldn't find the antelope once I went all the way around on this other road. Finally, Steve stayed with it. I found him. Steve said as we got done field dressing the antelope that his back was really bad, and I would have to carry the antelope on my back to the truck. So I put the entire antelope on a frame pack. And one thing, I'm a little guy. But I'm wiry. And I just said, you know what?
I'm determined.
And I'm not stopping. So I didn't. And the last time I looked behind me, Steve was way behind. And the next time I looked, he was not there. I never saw him again.
Yeah, we're recording a podcast.
My friend Steve Schindler just showed up.
Steve Schindler, welcome. We're telling a story about how an injury almost
died. We're telling
died.
A story about Steve Dalby, whom you know, shooting an antelope and froze to death, Crick. And I carried out for him, and he just disappears. So I finally realize I have no idea where my pickup is. It's dark at this point, and I got an antelope on my back. So the first thing I did, obviously, was got rid of the antelope, but I had no idea where I was in the middle of this froze to death country. Only thing I could see was the cooling tower for the Colstrip power plant in the distance. So I knew that way was southeast, but I spent the entire night out there with a wet t-shirt from sweating up carrying an antelope in October. Damn near died freezing to death. Anyway,
that's what would be called McKean damn near died.
McKean damn near died.
And you made it out?
I made it out fine.
Do you have any ill effects of your experience?
Actually,
he lost a lot of weight.
Lost a lot of weight. There were two remarkable things. One is just as the sun was setting, a bunch of geese came over, and this is big alkali flat. I think the geese set their wings. They started feathering down. I'm like, are they going to land on water? There's no water around here. One by one, the geese bounced across this hard pan, alkali flat. They thought it was water. So I got to see geese totally fool out. And they were, I've never seen an embarrassed goose, but they acted like, oh, I didn't see, nobody saw that. No, nothing to see
fly
here.
Away,
fly away.
Fly away. We're fine.
The second thing is, in the morning when I came back to find the antelope that I had jettisoned, I found a big old arrowhead right next to the antelope.
And you
lived.
That was
kind of cool. I lived.
What was there, like, what was the most desperate moment that you had?
Most desperate moment, I was cold that night.
Yeah.
I mean, I was sweaty. I had zero gear. And I realized the wind was kind of coming up, not quite like this, but it was cold. I realized I needed to protect myself thermally. So I got in this cut bank, kind of tucked my arms in. And I must have fallen asleep a little bit because my grandmother, who had been dead for several years at the time, kind of came to me in this little dream state and said, my grandma was not an outdoors woman. She said, just go uphill and you're going to run into your pickup. So when I kind of parsed that out, she was right. As long as I just followed every little rivulet uphill, I was going to come to a ridge. All the roads are on the ridge. And I did that and I got
you
out.
Won? Thanks, Grammy. And you lived.
I lived.
Here today.
Yeah.
Fort Peck.
Oh, so Steve, the reason I was carrying the antelope, Steve's like, I'm going to mount it. I don't want to, you know, drag the skin off of this potential mount. So we got back to the pickup. He also spent the night on the prairie. We got reacquainted with each other, and he said, no way am I going to mount that antelope.
That's a good way to end it. Thanks, Mr. McKean.
Yeah, that was
we
fun.
Didn't catch any damn fish, but we did drink some beer.
We drank a little. My beer is totally frozen.
Is it?
Yeah.
Mine probably is, too. We would crack some, too. See ya. That's it. That's all. Another episode in the books. Thanks to Andrew McKean and the grand folks of Glasgow, Montana, for having us up here in this beautiful lake here in Fort Peck. If you ever can make it up in this country, please do. It's a great place to be in a beautiful, beautiful part of our world. And hopefully you can all go out there and, as Andrew told you, take three people hunting every year. If you're a veteran hunter and if you're a new hunter, look for a mentor. And find someone that you trust that can show you what they know and then take it from there. There's no easy solution to that. That's for sure. What else? Well, we're standing out here in the middle of nowhere, but we still have some stops left in the Meat Eater Live Tour. We're going to be Austin, Texas on April 2nd. We're going to be at the BHA Rendezvous in early May in Boise, Idaho. Those are two stops that I'll be at, and I'll be on stage there with Steve, Yanni, Cal, and others. And it's fun. And speaking of that, you know, BHA Rendezvous is coming up. Hopefully you get out there and see us. It's going to be a fun weekend. For conservation, for hunting, for fishing, and all the things we love to do. And we're also thinking of coming out with some brand new Hunting Collective merch. So if you go to the Meat Eater store and click around, you'll find that Hunting Collective merch. But there's some new stuff coming that I think you all will enjoy. And I think this is a good time to let you guys all know that we are planning a big relaunch for the Hunting Collective. A new style, a new format, a bunch of new stuff coming up. We want to relaunch because we want to get better. I've listened to all the feedback. I've heard a lot of things from a lot of people. I've been happy with the success of the podcast, but we're not going to rest on it. We're going to keep on going, and we're going to do it with you along with us. So with all that said, see you later, man. We're going to go try to catch a fish, maybe bring some stuff back home, maybe a nice lake trout for the fryer. We'll see you next time, next Tuesday, on the Honey Collective. See ya.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, everybody knows Weber grills. I've been using Weber grills my whole life, and check it out. They got a pellet grill, the Weber Searwood pellet grill. Now, with a pellet grill, you can smoke, roast, and sear on the same grill. You can go from low and slow, okay, on smoke boost mode, or crank this thing all the way to a heat sear at 600 degrees. It's got a full great sear zone, so you can put more food on the flame. Get fired up for your new Weber Searwood pellet grill.